Hey, Asha. So does the Supreme Court decision mean that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is basically inoperable?
It's complicated. I'm Asha Rangappa. I teach national security law at Yale University. I'm a former FBI special agent, and I'm a legal contributor for ABC News.
And I'm Renata Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst.
And we're here to help you understand topics that can't be boiled down into a soundbite or a tweet. So, big news that I don't think was completely shocking to anyone. And Renato, I know that you had some pretty big picture takeaways that we can unpack today. So, what was yours when you were on all your news channels?
I really think that as a practical matter, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is essentially inoperable. And I think that the Supreme Court made a calculation here. They understood that if they punt this to Congress, Congress, for all practical purposes, will not be able to reach an agreement on anything. Congress can't agree on even minor things nowadays, like keeping the government functioning and that sort of thing. There's no way they're going to agree on this issue, which is so partisan. And so it allowed the Supreme Court to punt on so many issues that would have required them to, first of all, I think, have division between justices. I mean, they were 9-0 on the judgment, and that, you know, they were able to have a per curiam opinion that everyone could sign on to. But also it allowed them to not have to spell out things that might create some conflict or, you know, get justices unwilling to sign on.
Yeah, they wanted to keep everybody in their safe spaces, it sounds like. So let's just quickly rewind and recap. So I think we all assumed that the court would find some kind of off-ramp. The question is, which was the off-ramp they were going to use, right? So there are a few off-ramps they did not use, and I think it's worth highlighting that, right? They did not decide that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment doesn't apply to the presidency, or that the president is not an officer of the United States. I mean, I think that's notable, since that was like apparently a theory that was in play, and I guess we can be happy about that. But then they had to find something that could be, I think, uniform and applicable nationwide. In other words, if they only based their decision on Colorado, or, you know, Colorado's procedures or something, then it would still leave open the door for other states to have their own processes. And as you noted, Renato, they took the off-ramp that we had discussed in a prior episode. Essentially, they didn't use this phrase really, but that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment isn't self-executing, that it requires enabling legislation by Congress. And I would unpack the opinion as sort of going in two parts, right? And the first part is where there was some unanimity. The first part got to this whole uniformity and federalism piece, where the court said, look, if states could just decide on their own through different processes, different fact-finding standards, different evidentiary bases, that someone could be disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, you know, you would have this patchwork of outcomes, basically. And you'd have a candidate that appears on some ballots and not others, and that they did not believe that it was the purpose of the 14th Amendment to give states that much power over something that had such national implications. So they left open the possibility that states could disqualify candidates for running for state office, but they said, you know, it doesn't make sense, I guess, from their reading of the purpose of the 14th Amendment and kind of the structure of federalism, that any one state could have this kind of of national implications. So what do you think about just that piece? Like, let's just stop right there.
I mean, I think that it is a plausible reading of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. I think I had said previously, if you had ChatGPT or OpenAI or whatever, look at the text and history of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, I do think it would have reached a different result. But I think human beings and their judgment, which is why we have human judges, we don't have a bunch of robots. I think the justices just did not like the impact that this could have on the country. So I'm not entirely surprised by that. I'm not really bothered by it either. I understand that decision. I think that there are elements of this that in which the opinions are written around hard issues, and it's at times a little disingenuous. I think it's a bit essentially what you and I expected.
Yeah, I feel like I need to think through that part of it, because there are still some things that don't sit quite right with me. I think it seems right kind of as a policy matter, but I think they sidestepped some of the constitutional issues, which really does give states the power to determine, you know, how their elections are run. And, you know, it's not necessarily unheard of for candidates to appear on the ballots in some states and not others. I mean, I think back to 2016, and I believe that Evan McMullen, for example, who was running as an independent, appeared on some ballots and didn't others. I mean, he may not have necessarily been had any real chance of winning, but you know, that to me, the lack of uniformity isn't necessarily to me fatal, especially when you have this other constitutional provision. And I'm not sure that they really made a clear legal and textual argument as much as a policy one. I also thought it was a little overbroad in terms of the federalism argument, because they said that the states shouldn't have this power over any federal office. But if you think about, for example, state senators or state representatives, even though that has national implications, that really is about the constituency are the people of the state. Like, why would this, you know, I, as a resident of Connecticut, don't want an insurrectionist representing my state as a senator. Like, why would that not also fall in? You know what I mean? Like, I get the president argument, but they were going this way by saying this is an office that should represent, you know, that it's the will of the whole people. Yes, that's true for the presidency, the vice presidency. It's not necessarily true for all federal offices. So I don't know. It to me was like a kind of a kabuki dance. A constitutional kabuki dance.
A couple reactions to that. I mean, I think that, first of all, you're right. The states have all sorts of requirements to get on the ballot. It can be very complicated in certain states, at least my state included. You know, there's signature requirements. Sometimes if you are not from a party that already is going to be on the ballot, it can be very challenging. And that's part of the challenge that no labels and some of these other folks who want to get on the ballot have when they're trying to mount third-party challenges. You know, if you recall, when Ross Perot back in 1992 was running for president, that was part of the challenge for him, was just getting on and off the ballots. So sure, I think you could take a different perspective on it. I mean, you could imagine a world in which the Supreme Court acted the way that many of my Federal Society friends acted in other circumstances. I mean, what is interesting to me is, you know, I have a lot of, friends who I've known from law school and other clerkships and other situations that are super Federalist Society types. And they are like, policy be damned. The Supreme Court's not a policy in making institution. They're focused on the text. I mean, you know, I could see a circumstance where they're like sitting there looking at that text and like, hey, there's words here. We have to give them meaning and so on and so forth. And so I think that this is a situation in which you had, you know, you had the Republican appointed justices eager to not take that approach. And then you had, I'd say, the Democratic appointed justices you know, more comfortable with an approach that takes into account it's the impact of this decision. And I think for those justices, it may be unthinkable. I mean, I think what was doing a lot of the work, you could tell not only in the oral argument, but of course it came into the decision, that discussion of a patchwork that you mentioned a moment ago. I think this case was driven by the impact and the result it would have in the country more than anything else, which is why I said I think human beings achieved a different result than AI would.
Yes, and it is interesting that when it came to the argument over, in the oral argument over whether this applied to the presidency or whether the president was an officer, they were very in the weeds on how many times office an officer was mentioned in the Constitution. So it like got really, you know, let's get to exactly what this means and what does officer mean here and what does it mean over there. And then, but when it gets to like beyond that argument, it's like, well, yeah, this just wouldn't make any sense. So we got to move on. So, okay. But you pointed out that the more liberal justices were willing to go along with this, and that was pretty clear. So this whole, you know, the states can't take over, you know, the control of something of this magnitude when it implicates federal elections, fine. But then they went one step further, where the court, the majority, that's a per curiam opinion, it wasn't authored by a specific justice, but it there really was like essentially a majority opinion, and they were labeled concurrence, a concurring opinion, but they were basically dissents, I think, said Congress, you know, this belongs in Congress because Section 5 gives Congress the power to effectuate Section 14. The 14th Amendment. And then that goes into this whole exegesis about legislation and how historically, initially, Congress had passed an act enforcing Section 3. And then I don't know what happened to that act. It's no longer in effect. But in any case, they basically say the only other thing that exists right now that Congress has passed as legislation is the section of the criminal code that criminalizes insurrection and rebellion, 18 U.S.C. 2383, which is the one crime that Jack Smith did not charge Trump with, P.S. And to me, that's really narrow, right? I mean, to say that Congress has to pass specific legislation, I guess maybe we can pause here because people might be wondering, well, then what else would Congress do? Like, how else would you leave this in Congress's hands and they could determine that he's an insurrectionist or anyone is an insurrectionist besides passing legislation, creating a process to determine that?
Right. I mean, what you'd have to do is create legislation that would pass legislation that would create some sort of process, that there would be legal challenges there, right? There'd be due process, you know, challenges and so forth as to how that determination is made, I would presume, and whether or not the definition of insurrection in that statute is comports with the definition of insurrection in the Constitution and, you know, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And then, you know, realistically, I would assume that if that situation came up, we might see a Supreme Court opinion striking down that piece of legislation. I think the reason, Asha, that they wanted legislation is partly because they were afraid if they didn't take this particular off-ramp, you could imagine a circumstance in which there was a challenge after Trump won, right? To Trump receiving the electoral votes on January 6th of 2025. And so I think that's, you know, potentially was on the justices' minds and why they sort of created a process that I think they knew or put set a bar that I think they knew would never be cleared.
Yeah. And just to make clear where I was going with this is, because this is the my thought immediately after and kind of thinking through the implications, what the court was saying is that no other process, even if it was coming out of Congress as a body, would count towards determining disqualification. So, for example, Trump was impeached for inciting insurrection. Now, the Senate did not, they acquitted him, but let's say the Senate had convicted him. He left office, maybe for whatever reason, they never voted on giving him the penalty to prohibit him from holding office. My understanding is that under this decision, even being impeached and convicted of inciting insurrection by Congress would not suffice to disqualify him under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Similarly, the congressional, you know, the committee, the January 6th committee that had factual findings that basically determined. Now, of course, that was a committee, that wasn't all of Congress, but assuming, let's say there was some process by which Congress could adopt all of that and agree that as a matter of fact, that Trump was, had engaged in insurrection, that would not count, right? Like they have to pass a law. It couldn't even be a law about a specific person because that would be a bill of attainder. So literally the only thing, as far as I can tell, I mean, you can correct me, is to create some kind of procedure, as you said. Like they have to just create a procedure, which, you know, then not only do they have to pass that, then, you know, someone would have to engage in that procedure. I mean, it's never going to happen.
Of course. And you're right. I did miss the point you're trying to make there. You're right. What you're referring to is essentially like a resolution, right? Where you have a resolution where it's like, hey, we resolve X, right?
So like
we
a joint resolve. Resolution. Yep.
Yep. We resolve that Trump engaged in insurrection and yada, yada, you know, or censure or anything like that. That's not going to cut it. So you have to have a procedure. You're going to have to get 60 votes in the Senate. And I think the justices of the Supreme Court understood exactly what that meant. It really means that I think we're not going to hear much about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment until this becomes American history. In other words, I think that, well, let's put this way, I hope that there comes a time 20 years from now, Asha, or something like that, when we can look back at the Trump era the way that people now look back at the Clinton era, the George W. Bush era, and people can have discussions about that era that are not entirely partisan. And perhaps there can be some sort of bipartisan way of taking a look at this issue. But I think that's the earliest that we can expect any sort of action being taken related to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment in our lifetimes.
Yeah, I agree with you. I just want to add one point, and I have something to also add to what you just said, that, and this is something that the three liberal justices point out, is the majority basically has created a situation where it only takes a majority of Congress to block legislation, you know, to essentially find some way of adjudicating insurrectionists. Whereas the Constitution then requires 2/3 vote to lift the disability. I mean, in other words, they said it doesn't, you're allowing the ability to even make the determination to be a lower threshold than even to lift the disability. And this, you know, again, policy, this doesn't make any sense. And it's also not consistent with what's in the Constitution. And I think to your point, we should note that I would say, you know, in every moment where there's been, maybe not every moment, I don't know every moment, but every recent moment where we've encountered a major, you know, scandal or issue, usually after the fact, pretty soon there's a way to look back and say, how do we correct this? How do we create some guardrails? So after Watergate, you had all kinds of reforms, you know, the Ethics in Government Act of 1978, you had after Iran-Contra, you had intelligence reform to create congressional oversight. You know, after Bill Clinton, the independent counsel statute was allowed to sunset and they created the special counsel regulations. It is quite astonishing that after an attack on the Capitol, there has been no effort to create any kind of guardrails to really prevent that I mean, I guess maybe some changes to the Electoral Count Act. It's not even clear to me that, you know, that would help. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's going to be 30 years. I think it's going to be like 100 years. Because at this point, all you need is a majority of former insurrectionists to get into office and you're set.
Yeah, that's me being optimistic and hoping that this is a short-term blip in our country and that somehow we're going to return to a space where you have two parties that are both rejecting the sort of politics that we have right now. Right? You're right that that may not happen. But I will say this. I do have to give some hope because I feel there's been a lot of people very upset about this decision and about other developments. You know, I remember, in our lifetime, a time when, gay marriage was considered like a third rail that Democrats certainly couldn't touch. It was used as a weapon in the 2008 election. And, you know, Bill Clinton engaged in conduct that nowadays I think people in his own party would find highly problematic and would treat very differently than they did during his presidency. I do think that there is an opportunity for change and growth. And I do think the younger generations that we have different values. So I do have some measure hope that we can look back in this era and decide that this was something that we don't want repeated. But you're right. It may be closer to 100 years than 20.
Finally, to close out, I just want your opinion on what you think the dynamics were that were happening in that opinion, because we did have five justices unsigned, you know, on this whole kind of two-part analysis that I just said. Then you had the three liberal justices who were like, you've gone too far. But they were concurring opinions. They didn't say dissenting in part or anything like that. And then you had Amy Coney Barrett, like, in the middle that was like, you know, the court didn't kind of agreeing, like, court didn't need to go this far, but everybody needs to calm down and we just all need to be friends right now because the political temperature is too high. It was just kind of weird. There was a lot of, like, I don't know, drama happening there.
I think that the court, the Supreme Court, is more sensitive to criticism and more sensitive to the diminished respect that a lot of people have for the court than you might realize. I mean, I think the Supreme Court, justices of the Supreme Court could ignore all of that, right? They have lifetime appointments. They have all this power. They don't have to care, but I think they do. My read, and this is just purely informed speculation, okay, is my read on it was that the Chief Justice wanted to have a united opinion, wanted to have the court speaking in one voice. That's why you have that per curiam opinion. That's why you don't have all these separate opinions on that on this question. But I think the three Democratic appointees felt like they had given up too much of that and they didn't agree with all the language in it. That's why they wrote their own opinion nonetheless. They didn't want to speak in one voice and completely endorse everything in that opinion. And I actually think Barrett, you know, she's turned out to be one of the more moderate of the Trump appointees and of the six Republican appointees. And I think she's very sensitive to the perception of the court. And so I actually think she would have rather had a very narrow decision. You could imagine the decision could have been much shorter, much more narrow than it was, and reached basically the same result. And I think that's what she was trying to say. Obviously there's a lot of criticism of how Barrett got onto the court and of her and her, you know, all sorts of things regarding her. But she's turned out to be somebody because I think of her concern about how far and how fast the court has gone. Somebody that liberals who are making arguments to the court they're trying to persuade her. Like, she is one of the two justices that they're really focused on persuading. And so I think that's notable. And you got to see that here. And it's a dynamic that our viewers should at least be aware of.
Yeah. And I think it's worth also highlighting that had Clarence Thomas recused himself, as he ought to have done, since his wife was implicated in the underlying facts before him, of the case before him, that would have really been an interesting outcome as well.
So, Asha, going from the hallowed halls of the United States Supreme Court to Manhattan and state court proceedings, we have a perjury guilty plea by Alan Weisselberg, which is quite interesting.
So where is this coming from? So because Weisselberg, he testified in the criminal case against the Trump Organization, in which the Trump Organization was found guilty. And then he basically was the fall guy and he went to jail for some period of time. 5 months, I think, was he sentenced to, something like that. He also testified in Letitia James' civil fraud trial. And I believe he is set to be a witness in Bragg's case as well.
Yes. So what happened, so this reportedly is relating to statements he made in the civil fraud trial. And essentially, Bragg's team is watching that closely and basically are sending a message to him that if you lie, we're going to charge you. We're going to keep charging you every time that you lie. Like, we're going to continue to go after you. And so I will just tell you, I originally misread this. I mean, when I heard, okay, there's a plea agreement, there's a plea deal with Alan Weisselberg, my initial reaction is like, oh, wow, is Weisselberg now, you know, cutting some sort of deal with Bragg or getting some sort of benefit or anything along those lines? That's not the case. What's really going on here is that Bragg's team is trying to send a message because, as you point out, Asha, we have a trial, by the way, that trial that's going to be underway in a matter of weeks now, okay? The first criminal trial of a former president of the United States is about to be launched. And Alan Weisselberg is going to be a witness of that trial. He has proven, I think, despite the fact that he has provided some measure of cooperation with authorities, to be on Team Trump. He's received payments from Trump. He's got attorneys that are paid for by Trump. And it appears to me that the Manhattan DA's office thinks that his testimony, not only in the past, which they just charged him with, but also potentially his testimony at that trial might not be entirely candid and forthcoming. And so this is their way of sending a message to him and to other witnesses that if you lie on the stand, we're going to go after you. And a lot of our listeners are probably thinking like, well, yeah, duh. Like, so of course that's what happens when you lie on the witness stand. And I will just say that is absolutely not true. Most of the time, people lie in criminal courts and civil courts across the country all the time. They're rarely charged. And Bragg's team is sending a message that they're going to spend the resources to do it. And so everyone better pay very careful attention to their words.
Yes. And it sounds like there's also, I mean, he's been hit with other penalties, right? Like in the civil fraud trial, Judge Engoron also assessed a financial penalty to Weisselberg of $1 million, I believe. And I think that he was getting to, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Renato, but my understanding was that Weisselberg had been paid, I think, $2 million by the Trump Organization. It's not really clear what they claimed that payment was for, but it sounded like there was some sort of implicit quid pro quo, and the judge was kind of like, yeah, I see through the quid pro quo, meaning that somehow Weisselberg was getting compensated for continuing to lie on behalf of Trump. And Judge Engoron was like, no, you can't, like, you know, you can't get like a financial benefit for this kind of stuff, and was making him also pay back the state. So I don't know where that fits in, but you know, there was a financial penalty there for him as well.
There's definitely been a lot of discussion about that. I mean, I will just say that witnesses in criminal and civil cases bring with them biases bring with them a certain amount of baggage. Sometimes they do have a financial interest one way or the other in the outcome of the case. And, you know, while the arrangement that Trump had was aggressive, I don't view it as entirely unheard of. And the paying of fees is totally commonplace. And so I think, you know, I think Judge Eguiron was concerned about that. I actually think the AG's office rightfully kind of reined him in a little bit, because he originally wanted to wait to see what happened with this perjury charge before issuing his opinion. And I think the AG's office was wisely like, you shouldn't consider that, Judge. Just can look at the record in front of you, as opposed to looking, into this extraneous stuff. But I think, yeah, I mean, Weisselberg, it's interesting because he's somebody who could have been a huge figure, right? A somebody like these people in, you know, Watergate, who ultimately were key testifiers against Richard Nixon, John Dean, and others. And instead, you know, he sort of ended up being a figure who stuck with Trump to the end. And I mean, you see him represented by, Trump world attorneys, still giving testimony that while technically accurate, is very carefully worded to be supportive of Trump. And I think, it's going to play out in a very high stakes way in the upcoming couple of weeks, because everything centers in that trial around false statements and the business records of the Trump Organization.
So then, do you foresee, is Bragg's strategy going to basically be to impeach Weisselberg from the get-go and just be like, this guy is a liar? And, you know, in other words, is this going to become a showcase showdown between basically Michael Cohen and Weisselberg? And Weisselberg will really be the one that Bragg can be like, he's the perjurer here. He's the person who's lied in every trial. You don't believe anything. Like, he's going to try to make Trump look good. And then in that way, help give Michael Cohen's testimony more weight.
First of all, I love the reference to the showcase showdown. Okay. You should always take the second showcase.
You should always take the second showcase.
Okay.
For sure.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. I agree.
Regarding Weisselberg, I mean, we have limited information, but you know, they're going to have preps of Weisselberg. But if I was putting him on the stand, I would be agile enough to be able to go multiple ways with him. On my direct exam, I would start by getting everything, because I assume he's going to be called by Bragg's team. I would start by everything that is totally uncontroversial. You know, he's going to give you the truth of, and there's a lot of stuff. I mean, you need Weisselberg, if you're Bragg, to set the stage and talk about the Trump Organization, how it's structured, how it works, who's who, what's what, to get in documents and records. What's this document? Explain this document. I'd have him walk through everything uncontroversial. And then I would start asking him questions that were to sort of test the waters to see what he's going to say. Because I wouldn't trust that what he says during my prep sessions with him would be the reality of how it's going to play out in this witness stand, and see what he says. And I'd be ready to go multiple directions. I'd probably have, when I do cross-examinations, I have sort of different sheets of paper all over the place with different lines of questioning that I like pull out. Some of them pre-typed, some of them handwritten in the course of the trial, that I can pull out at different times depending on what they do. And I would kind of do that for his testimony. I do think that, you know, the whole defense strategy is going to be very focused on Cohen. So you're right about that. They're already attacking, like we discussed last week, he's a perjurer and so on. And I think that with Weisselberg, my guess is where they're going to end up is half a loaf there, where they're going to hack, because they want to credit some of his testimony, so they're not going to quite go as hard. The prosecution is not going to go quite as hard against him, but I guess that depends on what Weisselberg does.
Yeah. And just because I know that our listeners like have their brains are oversaturated with all of the facts of these different cases, and as is mine. But I'm guessing that Weisselberg comes into play because the way that this whole scheme operated was that Michael Cohen was providing sham invoices to the Trump Organization, though, for legal services. those invoices were being recorded with the Trump Revocable Trust. I assume Weisselberg had some role in that. Then Cohen was receiving checks from the Revocable Trust, which I assume Weisselberg had some role in that. And then those payments were being recorded in the Trump Organization's general ledger, you know, as these payments to for legal services. Again, I think Weisselberg had a role in that. And that's all. That is the center of why this is a false business records case.
That's right. I think that's a helpful background to sort of orient everybody. And just to be clear, I mean, I think, you know, Weisselberg could try to, you know, you could imagine a world or a universe in which Weisselberg tried to take the position that he didn't realize that those were false statements. So he thought that they were paying for legal services or that they were, in fact, paying for legal services. How do you define legal services? But that's not where this is. Everyone knows that this is not, these are not payments for legal services. And so the question is just how does Weisselberg characterize that, and what is his memory like regarding conversations he had and why he did things and so on and so forth. And, you know, trials are a game of inches. And that's why both sides are trying to fight for Alan Weisselberg and where his testimony is, because how a witness describes conversations and how they recount facts can dramatically alter the outcome of the trial. So, Asha, since you got the ball rolling with game shows, are you a Price is Right fan? I mean, what are your go-to game shows?
I have to be honest, I haven't watched Price is Right in a long time, but I really did love that show.
When I was a kid, I watched it every day.
Me too.
During the summer. Okay.
I hope this is not an inappropriate question. Is Bob Barker still alive?
I don't know. I don't think so, because Jim Carrey's been doing it a long time. I love Bob Barker.
But Pat Sajak is still alive, and he looks exactly the same.
I don't think Pat Sajak looks exactly the same, right? He's very well preserved.
Yeah. And I mean, Wheel of Fortune, I think, is a good show. Again, one that I haven't watched in a long time, but that's, you know, has had some lasting power. Speaking of game shows and game show hosts, Chuck Woolery, I remember, appeared in my Twitter timeline.
Yes.
He's like super MAGA.
Yeah.
Speaking of, like, I was like unfrozen caveman lawyer. Like, where have, like, I had not thought about Chuck Woolery in decades.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, okay, he's still alive and he's MAGA. And then he's disappeared. I don't know. I haven't seen him on my Twitter timeline.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where he went, but he was definitely bizarro.
What was his game show?
Love Connection. Love Connection, yes.
Love Connection, okay. Yeah.
Yes, Love Connection, that's
right.
Which
is also, I thought, was good. I enjoyed that.
That was an interesting one. I like Let's Make a Deal when I was a kid. Remember that one? Where, like, you'd have to...
Is that No Whammies?
No, I love that one, too. Okay, but Let's Make a Deal is where you'd have something, and then you could trade it for what was behind curtain number one or curtain number two. Sometimes you would trade it and you get, like, a donkey, and sometimes you get, like, a new boat.
Random.
Yeah. And so as a kid, that was hilarious, you know, seeing what people would do. But, yeah, there was definitely... I loved... what was that? Oh, Pressure Luck. That was great, too. Big Money No Whammies. That's the one you're talking about.
Oh, No Whammies. All I know is No Whammies.
The thing and it stopped, right? And
you had to mash it. Yeah. I just feel like all of these things that like Showcase Showdown, No Whammies, Big Money, like on Wheel of Fortune, Big Money. I feel like they are all applicable to our current political situation.
Yes, but
we're waiting for a Supreme Court decision. Like, no whammies.
But are these age things where, like, the young people are like, we do not watch game shows? Because, like, you and I watch game shows because we were home. At least this is for me. I'd be home during the summer. You had a lot of time in your hands, and there's, like, four channels. So, like, there's game shows on. Like, that's just what's on during the mornings or whatever. and that's what you're going to watch. Mm-hmm. Like now they're on like TikTok or doing something else. So like they, none of them even know any of this stuff, right?
They don't. Yeah. We're Gen X. We were unsupervised, benignly neglected. Our parents did not know what we were doing or care really, unless we didn't show up for dinner at 6 o'clock. Like as long as we showed up alive, don't you think? Like at 6, 7 o'clock, it was, their work was done.
I my parents were fantastic. Were fantastic, but yes, I mean they. I think it's fair to say that I could. They trusted me to do whatever in my room because they knew I wasn't communicating with like, you know, white supremacists or child exploiters or whatever online. There was none of that, right? We didn't have, you know, what was I going to do in my room? Play with my G.I. Joes or watch one of the three channels that we had, right? So there's.
But you could also go out for the whole day. Like they didn't organize play dates for you, did they? Mine didn't. Mine were like, see you later. Like I'd leave at like 10 o'clock in the morning. They had no idea where I was. Sometimes my friend and I would pretend to run away, but we would like run away to the other end of the neighborhood.
Okay, I had
and then come back at six o'clock.
I would tell my parents where I was going, but we would hang out around the neighborhood. I mean, the neighborhood had a lot of kids, so I'd go to so and so's house where it wasn't like a play date. It would be like, you know, I'd go hang out with so and so. That's interesting, mm-hmm. though. So you would just like go off, and your parents would have no idea where you were.
Yeah, we should save this for a future episode because not only would I be out doing whatever all day. And it was always like wholesome fun, but like my parents literally had no idea like what I was doing. If I had gotten abducted, I don't know what they would have done. But I also snuck out at night when I got into high school.
Okay. That is definitely got to be in our next episode. So stay tuned, everybody.
MSW Media.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.